Well, grace and peace to each of you as we gather today for chapel gathering. Creating the harmony, hearing young women's voices at EMS and beyond. It seems back in October 14th, 2013, in the Mennonite World Review, there was this article that was written by a Maria Christine Meyer Beiler. And therefore, the conversation has continued to expand from this particular article. And the chapel today and the forum following is a part of that conversation. Hearing young women's voices. And her question was, we who care about the Mennonite church need to ask ourselves, what's going on? If there are millennial women working in the church, why aren't they visible? So that's a question we will hold today. In conversation and in worship as we hear story and have fellowship around table and continue the conversation. Pray with me. Thank you, Lord, for this opportunity to gather together in this way. For the guests who are among us, for those who continue to travel and learn and work here at EMS, for those who are out there in the world looking to find voice in the church. We ask that your Spirit continue to move us to listen and to speak in grace because of your love. Amen.
Thank you. reading from the book of Exodus, chapter 1. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah and the other Puah, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, she shall live." But the Hebrew midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families.
Acts 16, verses 11 through 15. We set sail from Troas and took a straight course to Samothrace, the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia and a Roman colony. We remained in this city for some days. On the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate by the river, where we supposed there was a place of prayer, and we sat down and spoke to the women who had gathered there. A certain woman named Lydia, a worshiper of God, was listening to us. She was from the city of Thyatira and a dealer in purple cloth. The Lord opened her heart to listen eagerly to what was said by Paul. When she and her household were baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come and stay at my home." And she prevailed upon us.
First Corinthians 12:14 through 26. For the body does not consist of one member, but of many. If the foot should say, because I am not a hand, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, that would not make it any less part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would be the hearing? If the whole body were an ear, where would be the sense of smell? But as it is, God arranged the organs in the body, each one of them, as he chose. If all were a single organ, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, yet one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I have no need of you, nor again the head to the feet, I have no need of you. On the contrary, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker are indispensable, and those parts of the body which we think less honorable, we invest with the greater honor, and our unpresentable parts are treated with greater modesty, which our more presentable parts do not require. But God has so composed the body, giving the greater honor to the inferior part, that there may be no discord in the body, but that the members may have the same care for one another. If one member suffers, all suffer together. If one member is honored, all rejoice together.
I love hearing and singing music in parts, in harmony. I particularly love singing soprano because I have such a beautiful voice. But I will sing alto for the sake of balance. Usually in a congregation, there are plenty of sopranos, and I sing alto. But here at chapel, I almost never find myself singing alto. Today was one exception. I sometimes try, but the melody gets lost, drowned out by bass and tenor. This was so striking, I even started counting women in chapels. And I found that there are almost always way more men in this gathered body of students. Usually it's closer to a 2-to-1 ratio, men to women. This chapel service today isn't about singing, but it is about harmony. When we as a body are balanced and in tune with one another, when we do the work to hear each melody in harmony, each God-given experience and insight and gift, not because of some abstract desire for balancing numbers, but because we are not whole when voices are missing. That is when we are best reflecting God's tune into the world. And I assert that that is our primary mission together as followers of Jesus. So we take a couple of hours here to assess. How does our harmony sound? Where are the surprising or even dissonant tunes that we are somehow missing? We start by hearing some individual tunes, some individual stories. I invite you to consider the questions printed on the back of your bulletin as you hear stories throughout our time together and use them as a guide for a personal reflection. Where we go from here partially depends on where that personal reflection takes you and where our group conversation over lunch takes us. I don't know yet what outcome or outcomes of this time will be, but I believe it is a conversation that needs to be started. We have lots of stories of powerful and creative women in the Bible. In addition to Shiphrah and Puah and Lydia, who we heard today, there are Miriam, Abigail, Mary, Ruth, Esther, so many others. But the current reality here at EMS, in Virginia Mennonite Conference, in Mennonite Church USA, is that our stories, to continue these stories, are few. As a church, we are to proclaim God's reign, articulating and living into the vision we understand from God of the new creation. No one person can do that, as we heard in 1 Corinthians 12. So our missional activity has to include harmony. I started noticing this in Franconia Conference, where I worked for the past 4 years. Dozens of young folks are involved in many active ministries of the conference. But I was the only woman under 35 that I know of that was taking active leadership roles in the conference. This was shocking to me. I thought this was an issue that we had already dealt with. Few people have theological issues with women in church leadership by now, at least in the contexts where I grew up. And again, Franconia is a conference that is discerning, active, missional, reaching out and intentionally seeking those voices the church needs to hear. How could a conference that is so forward-thinking in so many ways be struggling to hear the voices of one group that is right there in the church? So I started looking around. It's hard to decide what numbers actually capture the problem. Young women seminary graduates, EMS graduates in pastoral positions, Mennonite women in any church leadership position. What does a church leadership position mean? We have Alicia Horst here, who is a social worker with an MDiv, and it is so necessary to have people like her in the church. But I'm focusing more within the church structure. In Virginia Mennonite Conference, out of 105 credentialed leaders last year, 16 were women. And if we trust Lonnie's age guesses, one or zero of them are under 40 years old. In Mennonite Church USA in 2009, the numbers of women in leadership were declining, and I don't know much more about that number. But that's the reason that the Women in Leadership Project was started by the Mennonite Church USA. Now, 5 years later, in MCUSA as a whole, the numbers are about 4-to-1 men-to-women ratio, both in credentialed leaders and those currently serving. And that includes any ministry, and we're assuming there are more women in chaplaincy and special ministry, so that's probably an even smaller percentage in pastoral ministry, in congregational ministry. Methodist numbers are similar, and I doubt that we are the only two denominations that are affected by this. These numbers sort of hint at what I'm noticing, but I'm looking for more. I'm looking for qualitative stories, not quantitative or numbers data. Where are women living out God's call? Why do they pick those areas? Have they experienced resistance, mixed messages, nudges to something other than direct church work? If they're not working in the church, did they just not want to? Why not? We'll start with my story and hear from some others today, too. I grew up in the Mennonite Church and have had women pastors as long as I've been aware, as long as I've noticed. In my experience, women in church leadership was an old issue. I know this is true for many of my peers. I studied social work in college because I wanted to make a difference in the world. And in my high school and college mind, seminary and Bible religion had little application to real life. People in the church acted out mission, but the church as a whole didn't. I've heard this view from my peers also. During school, I was introduced to Franconia Conference and given the opportunity to serve as a social worker in a congregation in Philadelphia when I graduated. I dragged my heels into working in the church, and it took years of people referring to my work as ministry, asking me to lead prayers, calling me pastor, telling me to go to seminary before I even took one seminary class. And then it took another year and a half before I considered full-time ministry. Full-time study, excuse me. I'm still not sure about full-time ministry. And importantly, it took all that time of seeing the church be the body of Christ from the point of view of leadership and experiencing God's presence in mission in the church for me to see work in the church as the sort of badass Jesus following that had drawn me to social work. I think this might be a common story for my peers as well. There are various reasons my story goes like this. My family was invested in church life, but didn't talk about personal faith much. I had low biblical literacy and low ability to articulate my faith and mission. In the broader church, the pastors that I saw were mostly older white men who preached and visited people in hospitals, which are both important parts of pastoral ministry. But I didn't see them as diverse leaders calling the church to a life-changing gospel. This is my story. It's just one example. It has parts that are not exclusive to women, but I think it may resonate more for young folks and more for women. We'll have to hear other We'll have to hear more stories to get a better picture of the church, and more stories from this place to get a better picture of Eastern Mennonite Seminary. And again, as we hear stories assessing the harmony, we're kind of doing research. We're getting a feel for what's going on, deciding if we need to take action, and if so, what action and how. This is the qualitative research I mentioned before, not numbers, but stories. As a social work student, I studied social research methods, so I can tell you a bit about qualitative research. Qualitative social research involves naming themes from multiple interviews. What is going on, and why is it happening? Statistics from it aren't generalizable to the larger population, but it's useful for getting those themes, which is, I think, what we need here. Next, we may be asking questions to find a solution. What's wrong? In this case, are these results that we're hearing true of EMS? Are they problematic? Where is change possible? These are a few themes we could start with from my story. How I experienced the church, how I understood or didn't understand mission, and my experience of call. The more stories we hear, the better picture we have of how we as a body perceive and are perceived by members, by some members, namely young women for now. So next we'll hear from Lana Miller, the undergraduate campus pastor, about her own experience both as a young woman in ministry and at EMU, and then at lunch we'll hear from others. Again, I don't know what will happen after this conversation. In the brief chats that I've had, lots of brainstorming ideas have come up about how to encourage young people, especially young women, and others who are underrepresented in the church whose voices we aren't hearing, to explore church leadership. After today, I'm hoping to have more and better ideas. And I know the seminary administration is listening. Right, Michael? In 1 Corinthians 12, after the passage that we heard, Paul goes on to describe the roles within the body for the purpose of upkeep of the body and of spreading the good news. I hope the individual stories we hear later can help us to consider this EMS body and then turn our focus outward. Who are we being in the EMU community and in Harrisonburg and beyond? How are we reflecting Christ together? How can we better be Christ's body? And how are we allowing the texture of many voices to create beautiful praise for God from this building, in this town, and into the world?
Thank you. I hope I meet Maria's task to provide a perspective from an undergraduate perspective here at EMU, my own story, and to give a bit of response. We'll see how this works. First, from an undergraduate perspective, about 10 years ago, the church, the Mennonite church, and I'm speaking mostly from a Mennonite perspective, engaged in the culture of call. Some of you might know these buzzwords. There was a Lilly Grant that funded many Mennonite institutions and others to talk about how we create this culture of call and encourage young people into ministry. And on this campus, we also engaged in some of this. From this activity, I was reading a report, and I just wanted to support some of Maria's findings as well. Here, we were working and continue to work with a ministry assistant and pastoral assistant program. So undergrad students are involved in these two programs. Most of the students who opt into this program at that time and continue to be a majority of female students. This could be due to the fact that we have a larger number of females on campus, but is significant nonetheless that more women than men opt into these ministry roles. In addition, there's the ministry inquiry program, which happens in the summer, placing students within different congregations and ministry contexts. Within this role, or within this program, there's a fairly equal number of male and female students who enter into this program, slightly higher with men. The finding of the Lilly Grant for those that participated in two out of three of these programs, MAPA or MIP programs, were that 80% ended up in some sort of ministry or preparing for ministry. So this would indicate that there are a lot more women entering into ministry roles of some sort, not always in congregational ministry, as Maria would have pointed out. So what's happening? If there are more women engaging in these sorts of activities in undergrad kind of ways, where are they going when they reach graduate school and other kinds of ministry professions? Now, another angle on what might be happening. Maybe I don't usually do this, but provide you a little bit of a rub to get you moving and a little bit stirred up so that the conversation becomes more active this afternoon, too. As I was preparing for today, I went to my bookshelf and found from the library of Larry G. Miller, my dad, one of these books that always kind of gets me to think outside the box a little bit. And it was in this book that I started reading a little bit about what I was thinking. The book is Jesus According to a Woman by Rachel Conrad Wahlberg, written in 1975, for some known as an evangelical feminist. She's writing in this chapter about Jesus and women preachers. She's talking about the Samaritan woman at the well meeting Jesus and also the women who found the tomb was empty. And she says, I want to read just a couple excerpts from here. It can hardly be overemphasized that women as mouthpieces, women as witnesses, women as preachers, as God's vessels of proclamation, have been virtually ignored in Christian history. While women as birth vessels or virgins have been emphasized to the point of stereotype. Now we suddenly see that the woman who proclaimed Jesus' messiahship while he lived and the women who proclaimed his risenness after the crucifixion have been underestimated. She goes on, women are seen as gossips, women go and tell their neighbors, women are talkative. We expect women to get excited about dramatic happenings. Women, we say, are emotional and are concerned about relationships with people. These are women categories. When men do the same things, they're seen as active and aggressive. They're labeled differently. Our perception differs frequently according to the sex of the perceived person. Our perception differs frequently according to the sex of the perceived person. I'm not sure that her words from 1975 are actually much different than maybe my experience of today. As I was talking with Andy about what I was going to be sharing this morning, he said last night that he did a case study in one of his classes this week. The case study was about an employee who was aggressive, decisive, and a type A personality. The gender was never revealed, but the perception of the class was that this person was a man, and they were very surprised to find out the case study was about a woman. I was struck by the song that we just sang this morning on page 34. We have images of women. A mother, you enfold me, you hold my life within your own, feed me with your very body from your flesh and bone. Then images of a father. Like a father, you protect me, teach me the discerning eye, hoist me up on your shoulder, let me see the world from on high. It's not that these images are bad, and it's not that all women are not wonderful, nurturing people, but it's also not that men aren't either. So what are the stereotypes that we continue to live into as we think about men and women and our roles within pastoral work? A story. As a 23-year-old woman entering into congregational ministry for the first time 15 years ago, I had only experienced a woman in a leadership role within the church one time, and I remember it vividly. A woman came to preach. It was really earth-shattering. From my memory, her presentation, I thought, wasn't bad, but was received with swift and harsh critique. I remember hearing that she lacked energy and a gripping message. But the critique that stood out most to me was that her voice was too soft and mild to make a good preacher. She made people fall asleep. I remember thinking, how can she change her voice? Is that even a worthy critique? While not stated specifically or consciously, it was clear to me that if I were to be a good preacher, I must preach like a man. Or at least a stereotypical man that I'd seen brought up and believed to be a good preacher. So at 23, while taking on a predominantly male role within this congregation, never had there been a woman in this church serving in a pastoral role, I was breaking some stereotypes, but I still carried with me many unspoken, unrealized, or subconscious beliefs about what it looked like for me to function and be successful in this role. And unbeknownst to me, and probably many in the church, the congregation also carried many of these unspoken, unrealized, and some subconscious stereotypes and expectations. So, within the Mennonite church, I think we still hold stereotypes. Rachel Conrad Wahlberg says, a stereotype is an exaggerated belief associated with a category and whose function is to rationalize others' conduct in relation to that category. Let me repeat that. A stereotype is an exaggerated belief associated with a category and whose function is to rationalize others' conduct in relationship to that category. Within the Mennonite church, and you alluded Methodist as well, and I don't know about that, men continue to dominate lead pastoral positions. And stereotypically, these are all assumptions I'm making, I think that we look to a particular type of man with specific attributes to fill these roles. Even men who don't necessarily fill these stereotypical attributes may struggle in these kinds of positions because of these stereotypes that we hold about what a pastor should be or what a pastor should look like. So what about women? Even if they have those certain male kind of attributes, the things that we expect out of this kind of role, they still have to face the obstacle of being in a female body. How many times have I been told women aren't supposed to act that way? Women are expected to navigate expectations of the congregation more times than not that has constructed a job description for a pastoral role from centuries of male leadership. We've come to expect pastors to function in specific ways, ways that may not always allow for the full gifts of women to be expressed or even recognized. So women are expected to navigate the complexities of this role while juggling the stereotypes and unspoken expectations that are embedded into it. Within my own life and ministry, I've had to maneuver these unseen expectations and stereotypes, navigating unwritten expectations that are unexamined by congregations and leaders within them. And it can be detrimental. So how do we start to examine some of these stereotypes? A few ideas to push us out a little bit. We need to start thinking about how we educate congregations, lay leaders, pastors, both male and female, about how to identify stereotypes and unspoken expectations. I think maybe first admit that they're there. We need to be intentional about hearing women's voices. I don't think this is new. This is something that's been happening for many years. But providing opportunities for women to speak, to have women lead in church. Because if we don't see women in these roles within the church, it's hard to encourage women into these roles. We need to be intentional about how we teach Sunday school curriculum, both to young and old, to spend more time examining women within the biblical and historical context of the church. We need to continue to think about what it means to create a culture of call for both men and women. We need to be intentional with congregations to think seriously about their expectations of pastors. We need to pay attention to the dynamics in the classroom, both in undergraduate and graduate levels. How are women's voices heard? How is space given? There's lots of studies about this. My undergrad degree was in biology and chemistry secondary education. In the sciences and mathematics, we always talk about how we are engaging women, girls' voices in the classroom over boys' voices. I think, are there some similarities between what's happening within a biblical theological kind of study and how we're also engaging women, and can we learn from some of those things? How are we preparing both men and women to encounter the stereotypes that widely are held by people within our congregations and cultures, even by ourselves? Sometimes I wonder, are we as a church really ready to address the underlying issues that continue to keep women from moving into pastoral roles?